And now, time to introduce tonight's very, very special guest speaker, Dr. Avery Broderick. Dr. Broderick got his PhD from Caltech back in 2004. He then accepted a postdoctoral fellowship at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics until 2007, when he accepted a special senior research associate position at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics, and then finally, in 2011, accepted an associate faculty position at Perimeter Institute. Now, Dr. Broderick's interests in astrophysics are broad, from the formation of stars all the way through to the extreme physics that happens in the vicinities of white dwarfs and neutron stars and black holes. Recently, Dr. Broderick has engaged in an international collaboration to try to image the horizons of supermassive black holes. Tonight, he's here to share how those imaging facilities are constructed and operate, and to share the deep new research coming from this area of extreme physics. So please welcome Dr. Avery Broderick.
Thank you, Greg, for the introduction, and it's really a pleasure to be here tonight and take you on a journey to the event horizon of a black hole. I knew I was in the right place as soon as I came in the door. Vikings in search of new horizons. Well, here we are. Okay. Frequently, when people talk about taking journeys to black holes, that journey takes place mostly in our mind, where we use the best theoretical information we have about these objects to infer what the space-time and what the astrophysics around them looks like. But tonight, I get to tell you, as Greg mentioned, about this very new real facility, this very new real capability to resolve the horizons and make pictures that perhaps won't look too different from the one shown here of what black hole horizons look like. So a good place to begin would be what a black hole is. And like so many questions in life, that depends on who you ask. If I were to put my physics hat on, and since I now live in Canada, my physics hockey jersey on, I would have to say a black hole is really a compact object, a defining feature. It's a compact object whose influence is felt only gravitationally. And to see how that can come about, let's do an experiment. Throw a ball up. And we know the result. It goes up to some height, comes back down. If we threw it a little faster, it would go a little further. If we threw it faster still, go further still. But this is not a linear process. If I throw the ball twice as fast, it doesn't go twice as high. And it's just a high school physics problem to work out how high it goes, written in terms of the Newton's gravitational constant, the mass of the Earth, and the radius of the Earth. And the important thing here is that for a very special velocity, the ball gets all the way up to infinity. And that's a finite velocity. It's the escape velocity. For the Earth, that's about 11 kilometers per second, so nobody's in danger of flying off the Earth in their car. The Sun's more massive, and even though it's somewhat larger, this escape velocity is about 600 kilometers per second. So quite a bit higher than the Earth, about 60 times as high as the Earth. This, of course, depends upon the radius. So if I imagine shrinking the Sun by two orders of magnitude down to the size of a white dwarf, the burnt-out husks of Sun-like stars, this grows to about 6,000 kilometers per second. And we could keep shrinking the Sun and keep watching it rise, and when we've shrunk it by another 2,000 down to 3 kilometers, it reaches a very special number, the speed of light. And this is actually a very old realization. It goes back to the end of the 18th century by John Mitchell, who's a geophysicist, a natural scientist, and a reverend, and this is really the only picture I've ever been able to find of him. Apparently a very modest man, too. And he pointed out that if you took Newton's gravity theory seriously, and you shrunk the objects down to this very special radius when the escape velocity reached the speed of light, you wouldn't see them anymore. They would be dark, because the light would never escape from their surface. They would be black holes. And so at the end of the 18th century, we already knew that if you took gravity seriously and pushed it to its extreme, the end result is a black hole. And the size you need to shrink something to is given by, again, a combination of fundamental constants, Newton's constant, speed of light, and the mass. All right. So that was the story in 1784. 130 years later, We've replaced Newton's theory of gravity with action at a distance with Einstein's theory of space-time curvature. Nevertheless, the story is alarmingly similar. If you take this seriously and you push it to its extreme, Karl Schwarzschild showed from the front in World War I, so there goes people's excuses for not doing their homework, he can find black holes in the middle of World War I, that you end up with a black hole. It's an extremely curved space-time, so curved that light can't climb out of, the potential well can't climb out of the black hole. And again, its size is this 2gm over c squared, this exact same thing we got in the Newtonian case. It's one of those great accidents of theoretical physics, and that's why it gets a little s after Schwarzschild. So that was about 100 years ago today. Since that time, people have been very hard at work trying to characterize what these objects might look like. And I think one of the pièce de résistance of black hole science at the latter half of the 20th century has been the No-Hair theorems. So tonight, we're raffling off a book by Kip Thorne. It's an obligatory joke. The No-Hair theorems are not, if you work on black holes, you lose your hair. What they really are is the No-Memory theorem. Black holes are fully characterized by only three numbers: their total mass, their angular momentum, and their electric charge. Okay? And that's really surprising, because this isn't true of most other things. A rhinoceros and an SUV are pretty similar mass objects, but they're very different, and you'd need more than three numbers to tell them apart. Okay? The universe is filled with gravitationally bound objects, again, very, very different. In other words, the universe is a complicated place, filled with complicated objects. But black holes are simple. Once they are crushed down to the size of a black hole, that's it. Three numbers, that's all you need to know. And in practice, only two. The charge, the electric charge, doesn't matter. So I'm just going to throw that away. And so the current state of black hole science, the end of the 20th century, is the Kerr space-time. This is black holes characterized by just these two numbers. Here's a picture of Roy Kerr. Okay? And there are a number of interesting features in the Kerr space-time. The first, of course, is the horizon. It's a little bit different than the size of a black hole in Newtonian gravity. The horizon here is really the point at which, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Photons not only can't get to infinity from the horizon, they can't cross back out of it. So even to an observer just above it, it looks like a black hole. It's black. But that's not the only interesting dynamical feature that's different than Newtonian gravity, and that will play a role in our journey tonight. The next one would be something called the innermost stable circular orbit. So in Newtonian gravity, if we wanted to calculate the orbit of a satellite or a planet, we would balance gravitational force with the centripetal acceleration. Okay, the idea is gravity's pulling something around in an orbit. And we have an expression for that gravitational force. One of the big differences between Newtonian gravity and Einstein's general relativity is something called the equivalence principle. In general relativity, not only mass gravitates, but energy gravitates as well, including the kinetic energy of objects moving in orbits. So I need to replace my force law with something that depends not only on the mass, but also on the orbital energy. And so you can see that it's possible to imagine a runaway where you have gravity, not gavity, gravity forcing you to go around in an orbit, but now you have orbital energy, and that increases the amount of gravity you have. So now you have to go faster, which increases the gravity. And so now you have to go around faster. It's kind of like trying to pay off one credit card with another. Before you know it, you're in real trouble. Far away, this makes very little difference, but as you get closer and closer to the black hole, at some point, when this orbital energy becomes very significant in comparison to the rest mass, no stable orbits can be found anymore. There's simply no analog of an orbit inside here where stuff will stay. Another interesting feature, one that will show up in some of the images we produce, is something called a photon orbit. This is when the orbital velocity is equal to the speed of light. It's not a stable orbit, but a photon would, in principle, if you set it up exactly right, go around in a circle. And it's a mark of strong lensing. And the last is something called the ergosphere. So the black hole not only pulls on stuff, not only causes stuff to move around it in orbits, but also drags around the space-time itself. Objects within the ergosphere are inexorably drawn around the black hole. There's no way for them to go fast enough to see the stars overhead fixed. All right, they're always being pulled around. Imagine being on a merry-go-round that you can never get off. Okay, and that will show up at the very end tonight. But this is kind of the dynamical structure that these black hole spacetimes have that can impact stuff in their vicinity. Now, still, we haven't made it to the 21st century. I've been telling you something about the history of black holes. Why do we care now? We're a whole decade and a half in. And I think the answer is black holes give us an opportunity to study how strong gravity works. What do I mean by that? I mean gravity right near horizons. And that's kind of interesting because it's where general relativity makes a very different prediction from Newtonian gravity. It's where general relativity's predictions are 100% different. It's not just a small perturbation. And there are really only two places in the universe where that happens. The first is black holes. Okay, you're very near the black hole horizon. The second is not making things compact, not making them small, but instead making them very massive. And you can run through the math and see that if you had the average density of the universe with the average size of the universe, that this number is also one. In other words, when you make the size scale very large, you include enough mass, this becomes one by virtue of the very large mass. Okay, this is just a fancy way of saying if you want to do cosmology, you better know your general relativity. But it also means that the other place where this is one is on very large scales. Everything in between is the rest of the universe. All right? Every test of general relativity that's been made to date lies between these two extreme cases. And in some sense, the extrapolation from the kinds of tests you can perform with binaries, with torsion balances in the lab, those tests are as far removed from the scale of the universe as they are from the physics around black hole horizons. And the past 20 years, the story of cosmology has really been the dynamics of the universe. It's really been testing what's the universe made out of, how does it expand. And the conclusion's been that 95% of the universe has to be something different than you and me and the Earth and all the stars and everything you see. 95% of the universe has to be either this dark matter or even worse, this dark energy. Okay? And that's really the price of assuming general relativity should be describing the universe on these scales, where general relativity is making this 100% difference. Now, I'm not saying that dark energy and dark matter aren't there. However, were I to come to you with a theory that explained everything, all you had to do was invent 95% of the universe, you might be skeptical. That's the state of cosmology. We found something quite extraordinary. Okay. What about black holes? And the answer is we don't really know. It's only very recently we've started to get answers to how gravity works right around black holes. So that means that there are some big questions that we don't have answers to. First, do black holes even exist? Are there these things that you go through and you never come back? And if they do exist, if there are things with event horizons, can we describe them with general relativity? Do we understand how they really work? So those are the physics questions. Of course, I also have an astronomer hockey jersey. I'm an astrophysicist, so I'm half and half. From an astronomer's perspective, black holes are very different. They certainly exist. We see very massive, compact things, and they seem to come in two flavors. A stellar mass black hole, things that are about 10 times as massive as the Sun. We see them when they're gobbling up companion stars. And the supermassive behemoths that lie at the center of nearly all, if not all, galaxies. Every galaxy has one. These guys range in masses from about a million to tens of billions of solar masses. So enormously massive objects. There may be something in between. There's circumstantial evidence, but no conclusive evidence as of today that intermediate mass black holes exist, something that would bridge these two. So really, two flavors. I'm going to be talking today really only about these supermassive guys. From a physics perspective, there's no difference. It's just a scale. But nevertheless, those are the guys we're talking about making pictures of. The other thing an astronomer might tell you is that black holes aren't black. They're the brightest things in the universe. So here's an image of a quasar, an accreting black hole, a black hole interacting with stuff around it. And that's the black hole. That's not the galaxy. All right? It has a luminosity of about 10 to the 47 ergs per second, and for those of you who don't think in ergs, that's about, well, it could be an order of magnitude higher if it were accreting slightly faster. For those of you who don't think in ergs, that's about 10 to the 41 watts, so it puts our light bulbs to shame. It's about 10 to the 30 times the total power output of Canada. That's about 10 trillion solar luminosities. And that's about one supernova every 15 minutes. And for reference, In the Milky Way, there's about one supernova per century. So this is an enormous luminosity by any measure. And it doesn't all come out in light. Okay? It outshines its galaxy by 100 times, but it doesn't only come out in light. It also sometimes comes out in the form of kinetic energy. This little linear feature here is not a misprint. It's not an accident. It's a relativistic outflow. It's a relativistic jet coming out of the black hole and propagating to large distances. And that quasar is not unique. There are jets coming out of a variety of supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies. Here's a radio image of Cygnus A. Again, you see these jets, and they terminate when they run into the gas that surrounds the galaxy. And they're not small. The largest one on record is about 4.5 megaparsecs from end to end. These dots here are these spots at the end where it's running into the intergalactic medium. For reference, 4.5 megaparsecs is about 4 times the distance between galaxies like the Milky Way. So these are truly intergalactic distances. And they're not without consequence. So here's a picture of a galaxy cluster. Everything you see in white is a galaxy. It's an optical image of galaxies all clustered together. The blue is X-ray emitting gas that fills the cluster. Okay, this is the gas that rains down on the galaxies and feeds the formation of stars, controls the evolution of the galaxies. The red is the relic of jets. It's the radio relics of those relativistic jets. And you can see they've carved out giant holes in that X-ray emitting gas. Those jets are controlling how much gas is falling onto those galaxies. So if you want to understand why galaxies look the way they do, you better understand how those outflows are formed. And in fact, it's exactly these kinds of processes that we think are resulting in an amazing correlation between the masses of black holes and the properties of the galaxies they inhabit. And this is actually somewhat shocking, because even though these black holes are supermassive, they're a tiny, tiny fraction of the mass of the galaxy. This is really an example of the tail wagging the dog. Somehow these two know about each other, and they have absolutely no right to. And we think it's feedback. We think it's these jets plowing into the gas around the galaxies and halting this accretion. So that means there are a number of astrophysical questions you might ask if we were astronomers. Things like, why are black holes bright instead of black? And how do they launch these outflows that control the fates of galaxies? And today, the story I'm going to tell is how we're starting to get answers to those questions by making images of black holes. Now, the cast tonight consists really of two characters. The first is Sagittarius A star. I might call it Sag A star. This is nothing more than the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. Okay, it's a black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's unique in that we know its mass very well. It's the only black hole in the universe that we can measure the mass of in the way you'd measure the mass of the sun with planets, by watching stars orbit. So here's actual data taken by Andrea Ghez's group at UCLA. There's also a group in Germany run by Reinhard Genzel doing the same thing. And they're watching, over decades, stars march around the black hole at the center, and by measuring the orbits of those stars, weighing the black hole. The movie up here shows the same data, or the extrapolated orbits, but in three dimensions. Okay, so this isn't, while this is an animation, these aren't fictitious. This is real data. So we actually know very well how massive the black hole at the center of our galaxy is. Of course, by far and away, this is the closest supermassive black hole. 5 million solar masses. It's kind of at the light end of that scale. Might give you feelings of inadequacy, although I'm perfectly happy not having a very, very bright, powerful AGN at the center of our galaxy. The second actor in our story tonight is M87. In some ways, this is very similar to Sag A star. It's very dim in some normalized units relative to how bright black holes can get. Neither of the luminosities of these objects is anywhere close to that 10 to the 48 ergs per second that I mentioned a couple slides ago. But it's also much more massive. Okay, this is about 2,000 times as massive, about 2,000 times further away, and it has one of these big radio jets. Right. So these are the two guys I'm going to talk about today. So I keep talking about massive black holes, but I don't say they're big. And they're not. I don't say they're big because they're not. They're actually very compact. We talk about compact objects for a reason. So physically, how big is a black hole? If I were to take the Earth and compress it down to the size at which it would become a black hole, it's about 2 centimeters across. Okay, that's the size of a squash ball. If I were to take the sun, we already said that would be about 3 kilometers. That's about the size of Waterloo. But even these behemoths, like the one at the center of our galaxy, Sagittarius Star, would only be about twice the size of the sun. 4.5 million solar masses, but still just twice the size of the sun. M87 would fit within our solar system. It would have a size of about 100 AU. For comparison, that's about as far as Voyager has gotten. That's the boundary between where we are, our solar system, and interstellar space. Okay, so by any measure, even the most massive kinds are small. Of course, in astronomy, what we really care about is angular size. And that's what determines what you can resolve. And so we might be more interested in what a black hole looks like, and there you go. They're black. The name gave it away. We see them only in relief. We see them silhouetted against background emission. If I imagined I had a bright background universe, they show up as a shadow. And the size of that shadow is really just the image of the horizon. Okay, it's all the photons that would have had to be gone on the horizon, but because the horizon's black, don't exist. And here you can start to see some of those orbits. Here's that photon orbit where the photons execute multiple passages around before getting off to an observer far away. The typical angular size of this is a little bit bigger than you'd expect, just because photons are being bent around the black hole. Okay, it's about twice the size you'd expect just from the Schwarzschild radius on its own. Well, that turns out to be very, very small. I'm not even going to talk about the size of a solar mass black hole. Okay, picoarc seconds is a unit you'll probably never hear again. Sagittarius Star and M87 are about 50 microarc seconds in diameter. For reference, one arc second is about 1/3000th of a degree. A microarc second is 1/1000th of that. So a microarc second's 1/3000000th of a degree. At 50 microarc seconds across, the black hole at the center of our galaxy is about the size of a poppy seed in Vancouver, seen from the CN Tower. So I don't tell you that just to impress you. I tell you that in part because there are fundamental limits on the size of the things that you can resolve in astronomy. The most important of which is something called diffraction. So this is an effect that arises due to the wave nature of light. It doesn't just happen with light. It happens anytime you have waves. Here's a picture of diffraction between a channel between two islands off the coast of, I think it's Spain. You see we have waves coming in, more or less parallel originally, and then they go out in these circular Huygens wavelets. And where the parallel waves have a very well-defined direction, the wavelet waves don't. We've lost direction information. You can see this on the wall over here. They have diffraction around little point sources. You see these nice little rainbows. Different wavelengths get diffracted by different amounts. So this is a familiar process. If you drove here tonight, you probably saw this when you saw passing streetlights or passing cars. That's diffraction through the camera pupil. When you see it with your eyes, it's diffraction through your pupil. And if I use my telescope out back with my daughters and try to look at stars on a very, very still, cool night, I too would see diffraction patterns. They wouldn't look like stars because my telescope is round, but I would see the central points of those stars spread out over some disk, an airy disk. And the typical size of that disk is the wavelength of light divided by the aperture size of my telescope. In my case, it's 8 inches. And that means my telescope can't resolve anything smaller than about 600,000 microarc seconds. So I'm not imaging black holes from my backyard. There are, of course, bigger telescopes out there. There are 10-meter class telescopes. Keck, VLT is not far behind. They really are diffraction limited. Here's a picture of stars in the galactic center region from the VLT, and you can see this nice airy patterns, central disk with a bunch of rings around it. Again, they're limited to wavelength divided by diameter of the aperture size, and that's about 20,000 microarc seconds. So even the biggest existing optical telescopes today can't do this. People are talking about building bigger telescopes. Those are bigger by about an order of magnitude, so instead of 10, say 30 or 100 meters across, 2,000 microarc seconds. If you wanted to do this with an optical telescope, if you wanted to resolve a 50 microarc second thing, you would need a 10-kilometer size telescope. And that's simply too difficult to produce. Now, it might seem hopeless to make the wavelength large. After all, if you make lambda large, you've got to make D correspondingly larger. At 1 millimeter, you'd have to make an Earth-sized telescope. But where nobody knows how to make a 10-kilometer optical telescope, radio astronomers have been producing Earth-sized telescopes for a long time now. And the way you do it is something called interferometry. It's really just a very precise timing experiment. The idea is we have these GPS satellites orbiting around, emitting some timing signal. You receive that timing signal, you know what time you are now, then you have the time of flight, so you can figure out the distance to the satellite and get some radius from that one point. You do this for three, you can triangulate your position. Okay, so we see this on cop shows all the time now. You could imagine trying to reverse that. So instead of having the receiver in your hand, you could have the transmitter in your hand. So now you emit radio signals, and all of the satellites now are the receivers. So they collect your signal, measure the time of flight, figure out how far away you are, triangulate your position. That would be a very inefficient way to run a GPS system, of course. But if you imagine taking the source and putting it out in space, and taking the satellites and putting them on the ground, that's really just a radio interferometer. Okay, it's a very careful timing experiment to find out where things are in space, essentially by time of flight. To make that a little bit more explicit, imagine that there's some source way up here, and we have two radio dishes down on the good green Earth, and those radio waves are emitted. They're continuously emitted. I only draw four crests, so these are like the tops of the waves, the ripples on the sea. Okay, crests of wavefronts coming down. They necessarily pass one telescope before they pass the other. There's a time delay, and you can do a little bit of trigonometry and find out then how far off zenith, what angle the source is associated with that given time delay. Okay, just a very sensitive timing experiment. Of course, doing this in practice is a little difficult because of weather. Radio waves don't propagate through clouds like they do through vacuum. That adds some offset, so you can't quite do that. But there's another effect, an interference effect that happens, because we don't know which waves to match up. Okay? If we look at a source that's extended, there's emission not only from the original direction, but emission from an angle just a little bit moved over. And that might be shifted in its delay by one wave period. And since we don't know what wave, and they don't come with little labels, they don't say, I'm this phase front. We don't know which wave this guy saw versus that guy, that signal looks the same. Okay? And the difference in time between those guys is just related to the difference in the angle. And that's just one wave period in time. Same is true for another wave one step over. And again, same distance in time. So we're getting angular information now on a scale that's lambda wavelength divided by the separation from this interference effect. You can think of this a little bit like a compound lens. Okay, there's only one detector at the back of this, but a compound lens that's looking at a lot of points on the sky at the same time, and they're all separated by this lambda over u. So that means that this kind of apparatus is able to measure something, I haven't quite told you what yet, but something on angular scales that are limited no longer by the size of the telescope, not the dish size, but by the separation. And you could imagine making that very, very large. Now, there's no free lunch, so there's a cost to trying to do this experiment. The first is you don't measure an image. You measure a mixed-up version of an image. So here's Van Gogh's Starry Night. This is the kind of thing you might measure. We call these visibilities. They're really a Fourier transform. The most important thing is all the information in this image is encoded in the thing you measure. It's invertible. If you measure this thing, you can go back to that. There's a well-defined mathematical procedure. Just to prove the point, here's Picasso's Guernica, different pattern, one-to-one correspondence. So that's the first thing. We don't quite measure a picture. We measure something that's a distorted picture. The second price is that we measure that distorted picture one pixel at a time. Every pair of telescopes measures this picture at exactly two points in this visibility space. One point because you have a baseline from this telescope to that telescope, and the other point because you have the baseline in the opposite direction. So these two are, of course, trivially related in some way. One pixel at a time. If you have more telescopes, you have more baselines. The baselines goes up as the square of the number of telescopes, so you get lots of baselines rather quickly. But again, one pixel at a time. You could imagine waiting. And if the Earth revolved around Waterloo, which just makes the PowerPoint animation easy, they get smeared out. Okay, so that's one way. If you're a little patient and you have lots of antennas, you can start to fill in this space. And in fact, if you look at radio interferometers, many of which exist, Typically, they do have lots of antennas for exactly this reason. So, two prices. First, we don't measure an image directly. Second, we measure that thing one pixel at a time. Nevertheless, very long baseline interferometers, Earth-sized telescopes already exist and have existed for nearly 50 years. There's a dedicated instrument, the Very Long Baseline Array in North America, that's existed for more than 20 years now, and has Earth-sized baselines. It has telescopes in Hawaii and all the way across North America. All right, and it's what's responsible for making images like this. This scale says milliarc seconds. We want microarc seconds, so it's 1,000 times too coarse, but this is better than a milliarc second. I mean, the resolution here is maybe a tenth of a milliarc second. Okay, and it's taken with instruments like the VLBA. Unfortunately, the VLBA won't do it for us, because its maximum, at the wavelength it operates, its maximum resolution is about 100 microarc seconds. Remember, 50 is our target. If we want to resolve horizons, we have to get better than 50. So this is great, but it's not quite good enough. It's not good enough for two other reasons. Okay, so the first is that resolution, 100 is bigger than 50. If we want to have an Earth-sized telescope, we have to push down to about a millimeter. Making the Earth bigger is very expensive, so pushing to higher frequencies is the way to go. You can do it. People do put these telescopes up in space. It's amazing. And the second thing you might worry about is getting a clear view. Just because you have resolution doesn't mean at the frequencies, at the wavelengths you're observing, you can see through all the stuff between us and the black hole. Okay, so getting a clear view. There are two ways in which we have to worry about getting a clear view. The first is the stuff right around the black hole itself. Any gas that's collected around the black hole itself. At low enough frequencies, long enough wavelengths, that stuff is optically thick. It's like a brick. In fact, in the vicinity of Sagittarius Star, there's a thing called a brick, because it's as thick as a brick. Can't see through it. Above about a millimeter, it becomes transparent. Then you can start to see through it. Okay, so that's one important reason. Not just resolution, to see through the stuff right on the black hole. There's also a scattering screen. We're not sure quite what it is, but it acts essentially like something that's coming our way. It's like the ice on your windshield. It blurs stuff. We have to scrape it off. We can't really do that because it's out in space, but we can push to shorter and shorter wavelengths and see through it. And again, a millimeter will do that. So there are a lot of good reasons. Resolution and getting a clear view to push something like the VLBA to shorter wavelengths, higher frequencies. And that's what the Event Horizon Telescope is. It's simply an Earth-sized, millimeter wavelength, very long baseline interferometer. And it consists of existing telescopes, so it's relatively inexpensive. We don't have to build a whole bunch of new apparatus. Most of these telescopes, or all of these telescopes exist now. The LMT and ALMA have just recently come online. And it's capable of resolutions of order 10 microarc seconds. And this is an international effort. Okay, many people are involved in making this work. And I want to emphasize that it's not a first light telescope. You don't need everybody to be working on the same page at first. Okay, here's a picture of all of our all of the telescopes involved. It's not a first-light telescope. A proto-version of the Event Horizon Telescope already exists and has been taking data. Okay, so this is just three elements. It's not that whole array. And remember all those caveats about not having enough elements. But this has already taken data in 2007, 2009, and then for the past 3 years, both on Sagittarius A star and on M87. So this isn't pie in the sky off in the future. This is stuff that's happening right now and has been happening for the past 6 years now. And the result is, we can already say that there's angular structure in these sources on scales of order 40 microarc seconds. You might notice that's less than 50. Okay, there's sub-horizon scale structure already detected in these two black holes. Now, there are a lot of ways in which the Event Horizon Telescope is going to get better in the future. The first is increasing sensitivity. Okay, putting dishes together at individual stations. A lot of these stations have multiple dishes. You can just add all their light up. So that's happening, or has been done. Pushing to larger bandwidths, it's kind of like, you know, including more colors in your analysis. This requires enormous data write speeds, 64 gigabits per second. So the next time you rail against your internet speeds, just have a little sympathy for these guys. Improving receivers and detectors, et cetera. Okay? The most important thing that's happening, though, is adding those sites. It's dealing with the sparseness of baselines, the sparseness of telescopes. And of those, the most important is ALMA. And the reason why ALMA is so important is that the signal-to-noise ratio, how sensitive one of these baselines, one of these collections of pairs of telescopes is, depends upon the sensitivity of both sides. And by including ALMA, which is far and away the most sensitive element in the Event Horizon Telescope, you make everyone else better. All right, so ALMA will serve as the anchor of the Event Horizon Telescope, making everybody else that much better. And nevertheless, it's not the only one that's important in the LMT. The Large Millimeter Telescope in Mexico is also being added. Okay, so many others can be added or are being added as well. So it's growing. We're going to have large numbers of telescopes. And that means that we really are talking about making images. So here's a theoretical image, the one on top. And I'll tell you a little bit about that in a short while. And here's the reconstructed image with 7 stations, 8, 9, 10. That's starting to look pretty good. You can find the shadow in that picture, 11, 12, 13. Okay, the image fidelity has really gotten quite good by now. So we're really talking about making pictures that look like this. You may not need 13. This is with typical radio reconstruction techniques. There are slightly more sophisticated things you can do. Even 7 stations, we might be able to get images back out. Okay, so it really is becoming an imaging telescope in the very near future. But this is where we are today. These are the points in that visibility picture. These are the pixels we have. So how do we make progress with so few pixels? And the answer is context. So my youngest daughter's name is Anna. Of course, when your name's Anna, eventually someone calls you Banana. If I showed you this picture and asked you what it was, you might have a very hard time telling what that, you know, or show you this picture and ask you what it is, you'd have a hard time coming up with an answer. Maybe it's a school bus, maybe it's a sunflower, I don't know, something yellow. But if I gave you 2 options, a picture of Anna or a banana, you could probably pretty easily tell. This is just a long-winded way of saying multiple choice is easy. All right, so the way in which we make progress with so few elements is multiple choice. We come up with other reasons to prefer one kind of image or another. So the rest of my talk tonight is going to be about how we're using multiple choice, how we're using context to say fundamental things about whether or not black holes exist, how they grow and shine, and how they launch those outflows. So let's begin with horizons. So for horizons, we only need that size, that overall size. So that means we can imagine that whatever we're looking at is to lowest order, lowest approximation, modeled by a blob. Gaussian blob, if we want to be specific, but just a blob of light with a characteristic size. These are our multiple choices. And those produce those visibilities, and we can compare those directly to the data. So these are our multiple choices. And this is exactly where this 37.2 microarcsecond size came from, fitting multiple choice blobs. And that's already very interesting when combined with why we think Sag J stars shine. So I mentioned that astronomers say black holes, or would tell you black holes are the engines of the universe, the brightest things out there. The reason is because they're not all by themselves. They're not alone. They're interacting with gas. And Sag J stars, no exception. There's plenty of gas available. And we think a lot of this gas is getting all the way down to the black hole. There are a lot of observational reasons, things like a nested structure and wavelength. Okay, it looks like a peaked density distribution around the black hole. Polarization things that tell us that a lot of this gas is really getting down to very small scales. All of these together tell us that Sag J star is accretion powered. Its luminosity is coming from accretion with a typical accretion rate of order 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. How does accretion produce luminosity? Not so long ago, I went to the CN Tower. I saw a lot of young people out there, budding Galileos, thinking about throwing things off. Of course, thankfully, it's all enclosed. Had they done that, they might have seen an accelerating penny go down as it converted gravitational binding energy to kinetic energy. Okay. Of course, that's not really what they would have seen. They would have seen that penny reach some sort of terminal velocity, and the reason is air resistance. And the rest of the energy is still being released, but it's now being converted to heat. And if it were falling fast enough, it would shine. And this is essentially what black holes do. On the Earth, it's not so impressive because, you know, you can't fall very far. The Earth's rather large. You can get out a billionth of a rest mass. That's nothing to sneeze at, but from the CN Tower, probably not quite that much. But a black hole is very compact. You can fall a long, long way. You can liberate almost a rest mass, and that's an enormous amount of energy. Okay? Typical fractions of the rest mass that are released in practice of order 10% for quasars, maybe a tenth of a percent or a hundredth of a percent for something like Sagittarius Star M87. Still enormous amounts of energy. And this is what powers the luminosity of Sagittarius Star. This is why black holes are bright, because they're small and stuff falls on. But then what? Accretion onto something like a black hole is very different than accretion onto something like a star or a table. This first phase of stuff falling on, this is accretion luminosity, that's the same in both cases. For a black hole, it simply passes through the horizon. And that was it. That's all you saw. But if it lands on a surface, if we were to drop this bag of rice on the surface, that energy didn't disappear. It goes into heating the bag. It goes into heating the rice. And that itself can shine. And if you doubt that, here's some striking evidence that that happens. This is heating from impacting the surface. This is a giant meteor crater. Okay? So the fact that we now have a very good size constraint means we can tell a story about the difference between surfaces and horizons. And that story goes something like this. Imagine you don't like black holes. Okay? And you want to replace it with something that has a surface, something that has a photosphere. Doesn't really matter what the details of that surface are, just something where we see where the stuff finally stops. The fact that it's got to be small, we have the size constraint from the Event Horizon Telescope, tells us that surface has to be very close to the horizon. It has to be very close to a horizon. Okay? And that means we have sort of a perverted inside-out thermal cavity. It's very close to the horizon. Most of the photons that are emitted from that surface are going to orbit around and fall back on. Most of them don't get out. A small fraction do. Of course, if we made the surface at the horizon, none of them would get out, right? So as we make it closer to the horizon, fewer and fewer get out. And this is really exactly what a black body cavity is, a pinhole in a cavity. You see photons bounce around. These photons thermalize the radiation. They thermalize the cavity. The end result is a very characteristic emission spectrum. Okay, this is how these forehead thermometers work. They look for this characteristic emission spectrum. Here we have lava. Here we have some metal. Here we have metal islets that are hot. Here we have some ingots that are hot. But they're all glowing in more or less the same way because they're all more or less the same temperature. And they're all glowing thermally. And that's how this surface, regardless of what it's made of, has to look since most of the photons come back down. And so we can go look for that. And it turns out that Sagittarius Star, given the accretion rate onto it today, should be about 1,000 degrees. It should look a little bit like this hot iron rod. It should peak somewhere in the optical or the near infrared. And this is what the observed spectral energy distribution of Sagittarius Star is. This feature here simply isn't there. This thermal emission from a potential surface is clearly excluded by at least two orders of magnitude. Okay, there's emission from other stuff too, but it's always below this thermal hump. Okay, so there we go. No surface. The stuff has to be disappearing. Now, not only did the size constraint tell us that we had to have thermal emission, but it also enters into making sure we can't hide this thermal bump in, you know, this sort of data desert at lower frequencies. Okay, that's ruled out because, again, the thing is small. And so, no, it doesn't have a temperature. It doesn't have a surface. There's no surface emission. There has to be something hiding where that stuff stops from us. In other words, there's an event horizon. So already we can say, for Sagittarius Star, yeah, probably there is an event horizon. This is the strongest argument you can make to date for the existence of black holes, the strongest observational argument. Other ways out of it, if you allow me enough tooth fairies, of course, we can wiggle out of anything. Theorists are creative. But you need things like wormholes, okay, or magical matter that stuff instantly transforms into, or you need to lose energy conservation, all kinds of nasty things. So yes, horizons exist. Okay, how do black holes grow? And what I really mean is, how do black holes like Sagittarius A star grow? Okay, so how do black holes like the one at the center of our galaxy grow? So far, I've talked about accretion as a story about falling. You may note that you didn't rush here in a panic because the end of the world is coming. The sun is not presently accreting the Earth. Right? Somehow the Earth has managed not to fall in. And it doesn't fall in because of angular momentum conservation. It's in an orbit. In order to move inwards, it has to lose angular momentum. Okay, So remember, angular momentum is that thing that makes spinning ice skaters spin fast when they pull in their arms. And so accretion is really a story about angular momentum transfer when we talk about stuff falling onto very small objects. And that's why we draw pictures like this, accretion disks. But not all accretion disks are the same. So this is pancakes. This is a thin disk. Okay, these are the kinds of things that quasar was. Very bright, very efficient. Things like Sagittarius Star and M87, we think look like this. More like a donut, a big, thick, puffy disk. And it turns out that that's like 99% of the objects out there. And that's a consequence of having a very low accretion rate. So when you think of accretion disks around the black holes tonight, big, puffy, thick, hot disks. Okay. And so the idea is to replace those Gaussian blobs, multiple choice of Gaussian blobs, with multiple choices based on big, hot, thick disks. Okay. There are certainly uncertainties. There are things we don't know about accretion, things like how that angular momentum transport is really happening, how stuff is giving up angular momentum to move in, stuff about the details in the flow, the detailed energy transfer amongst particles in the flow. The details of what's unknown isn't so important. Suffice to say that the detailed structure of these accretion flows, of even these thick accretion flows, is uncertain. But this is, in some sense, more like poetry than prose. There are rules to how we can allow these things to change. First, because we have theoretical leverage. We think we know some of the story. But second, because we also have other observations that have to be satisfied. So any model we come up with that's based upon these thick disk models has to both obey the physics we know and has to obey the other observations we see. Okay? After going through that process, you end up with images that look very much like this. So here's our thick disk, okay, a schematic. But this is what the image really looks like. It's orbiting around here. Okay? The first thing you notice is the shadow of the black hole. The shadow of the black hole is caused by that very strong lensing. We don't just see photons coming directly towards us, but we see photons that went behind the black hole, photons that went around the black hole once, even twice, etc. And that's responsible for this pileup of photons, this ring that we see defining the edge of the shadow. The typical scale was that 53 marker arc seconds, that image size. Okay, this is where that resolution element came in. It's also asymmetric, and it's asymmetric because it's orbiting. It has angular momentum. All right, one side's coming towards us, and various special relativistic effects conspire to make that look very bright, and there's a side going away from us, and those same relativistic effects make it look very dim. So because it's orbiting very rapidly, one side's bright and one side's dim. It's also thick, and that's why we see a big fat crescent instead of a very narrow crescent. It's this big puffy disk. Okay, and that's a characteristic picture. But they don't all look like that. That does depend a little bit on viewing angle. If we look edge-on, it's like the one I showed. But if we view it from 45 degrees at an oblique angle, it looks a little different. And if you change the space-time, if you give the black hole large amounts of angular momentum, it looks different again. So now our multiple choice is a more complicated set of physically motivated models. And you play exactly the same game, and you find one that fits the data best. And this, I would argue, is the closest thing we have to a picture of a black hole right now, and it's probably not that far off. And one of the reasons why I say it's not that far off is you can compare how good a fit this is to other kinds of things, these blob models, or rings, or point sources, or any other phenomenological models you can think of, and it turns out that those are excluded at 3 sigma. That is to say, this is 100 times more likely to be the right model than these other random things. All the physics that went into getting this right turns out to have actually mattered. And the most important physics that went into this was general relativity. It's this shape. And remember, there was a strong prior information about how that lensing should work because we knew what the mass of the black hole was. If we tried a different black hole mass, we'd get the wrong image. It wouldn't work. So I started off earlier tonight saying, on the cosmological scale, there might be some evidence that we're 2,000% wrong, right? 95% of the universe is something different. 2,000% wrong. We're almost certainly not 2,000% wrong now. Right now, down near black holes. Okay, so even today, I can tell you that black hole spacetimes are better understood than the universe at large. This is an exciting time to be looking at this stuff, not only because of our capabilities, but also because stuff is happening. Back in 2011, this gas cloud was identified, G2. G stands for gas. And this gas cloud has been plowing in towards the galactic center on a nearly radial orbit. Here it was in 2002, 2007, 2011. Here's an animation of what it should be doing as it whips around the black hole. And here's a picture of the velocity as a function of position on the sky of the matter in that cloud. The important thing is stuff on this side is moving away from us. Stuff on this side is moving towards us. That gas has started to move around on this white Keplerian orbit and has come around the back. So in this movie, when you saw it whip around, it's already started to do that. So this gas cloud's whipping around, shearing apart, and for the next 100 years is going to rain material back down on the galactic center. So this is really the right time to be looking. We're going to see it eat a gas cloud. And just by watching when that happens, by noting when that happens, tells us something about how matter gets from large scales down to small scales, because that gas cloud is not going to deposit the gas at the horizon, it's going to deposit the gas a little ways off, in the neighborhood, at about 1,000 Schwarzschild radii. And it's going to take some amount of time, anywhere from a month to a century, for that gas to dribble down, and that's going to tell us how fast gas can lose its angular momentum, how stuff really gets down just to the horizon. The second thing that's going to tell us is how much gets down. We can easily tell the difference between a lower accretion rate than today and a higher accretion rate than today. Okay, so these are images of different amounts of gas in the vicinity of the black hole. And that tells us about how much mass has been lost. Not all the gas from large scales is getting down to the horizon. We know that now. But we don't know how little. And this will give us a handle on that. Another thing we can start doing today makes this exciting, is messing with the stage, messing with general relativity. The idea is to take that kind of black hole solution I talked about, that's the result of the 20th century, and deform it, squish it, and see what happens. And there's a well-defined way to do that. The details aren't terribly important, but there's a way in which we can parametrically deform this black hole spacetime. And you can look to see if you can detect those deformations. And notice, remember, these deformations are exactly what the no-hair theorems tell us we cannot have. Black holes can't be complicated. So we're adding an extra complication and seeing if we can exclude it. And if you do that kind of calculation, these are the images that you would produce. So theoretical images that you'd produce. This is general relativity. This is deformed in one way. This is deformed in another way. And they look somewhat different. They look like squished images. And these are the kinds of images we can already distinguish. Right, so we're already able to distinguish between these guys. And this will simply get better in the near future. We're going to start putting general relativity to the test in a very real way. Okay. So how do black holes like Sagittarius grow? We think for those 99% that are like Sagittarius, those low accretion rate objects, they grow in those hot, dim, thick disks, and we think that general relativity is more or less okay. How do those outflows come about? So I said that Sagittarius and M87 were alike in very many ways. So I was thinking of a good way to describe that. My kids watched Zach and Cody. They're twins who are very, very different, often getting into trouble. So our black holes don't do that. Sagittarius and M87, though, are very much like that. They're twins, so similar that this graphic was commissioned for a press release on M87, but can equally well be used to give an impression of what Sagittarius should look like. But of course, they're also very different. M87 has this big, powerful jet. Sagittarius doesn't. This gray bar shows the same distance in units of the black hole size. That's the distance scale over which we would expect these jets to be similar. There's absolutely no evidence for a jet in Sagittarius. That's that dot there. Clear jet in M87. So how did these jets come about? Could we dim the lights just a little bit? In jet formation, the key feature is that ergo region. It's that region around the black hole that's dragging space-time around it. Imagine we had a magnetic field line being pulled in towards the black hole. This shaded gray region is that ergo region around the black hole where space-time is being dragged around it. And imagine dragging a stretchy string. This magnetic field's essentially connected to infinity, and this region down here is being dragged around. It's going to wind it up. And when it winds it up, we're going to see this wound-up helical wave propagate out along the string, this magnetic field, this stretchy string. Okay, that helical wave is carrying energy out of the black hole. It's sapping energy from the spin of the black hole. and carrying it off to infinity. And that's how we think jets form. That's the best story for jet formation. It's coming from the spin energy of the black hole, driving these helical waves going off of the black hole, going out of the black hole, electromagnetically driven. If you do a computer simulation that has magnetic fields, it has gas, has general relativity in it, here's one by Jonathan McKinney at Maryland, you see exactly this structure. Okay, you see these twisted up magnetic fields carrying, pointing flux, carrying energy away from the black hole, and in a collimated way, importantly. Okay. Now, those are theoretical. The key feature in that is twisting up magnetic fields. And the best candidate for that is the spin of the black hole. But we don't know that has to be the case. We do have other things orbiting around. The accretion disk should also twist up magnetic fields. So while there's theoretical reasons to think the black hole spin is important for jet production, there are no empirical reasons yet. Well, until now. We now have this size constraint. And this size constraint for M87 is a size constraint on the footprint of the jet, the bottommost region of the jet. Okay, it's how big the jet is when it begins. And if we were to choose one of these models that didn't care about black hole spin, one of these models that was driving the jet from just the accretion flow, one of these models in which black hole spin wasn't important, what you find is that you need to have a black hole that's spinning faster than about 0.4 in some dimensionalized units. Okay, in these units, zero is not rotating, one is rotating at the speed of light at the horizon. Okay, so this is really the range that's relevant for black holes, and it has to be rotating at 40% of the speed of light at the horizon. That's not super fast. It's interesting to note that Sagittarius Star, from the modeling I described just a moment ago and very, very briefly, should be spinning slower than about 0.6. Okay, so what we're finding is Sagittarius Star wants to be spinning slowly, but M87 has to be spinning, even if you are most sympathetic to jet formation without spin. More recently, you can do a much more sophisticated job. So this is like taking that blob model and replacing it with a more physically motivated disk model for Sagittarius Star. Here we're replacing it with a more physically motivated jet model. You can do exactly the same sort of game. And what you find is that this limit now moves up to 0.95. Okay. Different spin jets have different images. They accelerate stuff at different rates. And so you can tell the difference between high spin and low spin has to be spinning faster than 0.95. All right? That's enormously fast. That's 95% of the speed of light at the horizon. So that means that in M87's case, we think now that we have the first evidence that jet formation is a result of spinning black holes, that those outflows that rule the fates of galaxies is a result of black hole spin. Okay? So, let's come back to where we began, what a black hole is. So the first thing I hope I conveyed to you tonight was that the era of direct access to black holes is now upon us. Okay, and we're doing this by imaging their horizons. The Event Horizon Telescope is already observing. It's not something off in the future. And that means we're already getting fundamental insights into what black holes really are. We already know that horizons almost certainly exist. We already know general relativity is reasonably good on horizon scales. Okay, and a lot of black holes really do accrete the way we think they should. There's donuts and not pancakes, big, thick, hot accretion flows. And black hole spin really is what's powering those outflows that control the fates of galaxies. And of course, there's an awful lot of stuff that's coming up, things like putting GR to the test in a precision way and watching a black hole eat a cloud of gas in real time. And so stay tuned. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a Twitter feed question. I'll try to get right to it. It's actually a question that I had but was afraid to ask. From @Shergs. The question is this: if black holes emit radiation, wouldn't they also must have a temperature? I think I probably would have typed it about the same too.
So black holes in vacuum do emit radiation. They do have a temperature. This is this Hawking radiation and this Hawking temperature. That's exceedingly cold. The emission that I'm talking about is coming from orbiting gas that's heated to very high temperature. In these cases, almost a trillion degrees Kelvin. And so at a trillion degrees, it doesn't matter if you're talking about Kelvin or centigrade. A trillion degrees, it's very hot. Okay? And so that does have a very high temperature, but it's not the temperature of the black hole. It's the temperature of the gas around the black hole.
Thank you. At the back.
Hi. You mentioned early on in your lecture that you talked about photon circles. Now, you said that they were very unstable, I think. I might have misheard. But if I'm curious as to why they would be unstable, because if the speed of light is the same everywhere in a certain medium, like, why would that be different? Sorry, why would it be unstable?
So what I mean by unstable is not that the speed of light changes. It's that if you set a photon up on this orbit, it's either going to go falling into the black hole or flying out of the black hole on a timescale of about one orbit. If you set it up super accurately, you could get it to go around a couple times. Okay, but that's what I mean by unstable. That if you're ever so slightly wrong, then you go flying out or flying in. But it always goes the speed of light.
Perfect. Over here to my left.
I have two questions. One is, wouldn't the black hole suck itself in eventually?
The first most important thing is black holes don't suck. They're awesome. No.
But they do pull things in.
Black holes don't suck. If you replace the sun with a black hole tomorrow, the orbit of the Earth would stay unchanged. It would get a lot darker out, get colder, but the orbit of the Earth would stay the same. The second thing is, so by black hole, we really mean multiple different things. So one thing you can mean by black hole is the singularity at the center, something that has to be replaced with whatever quantum foamy thing you want to put there. The other thing we mean is the space-time. Now, the space-time is not something that you accrete. The space-time is a dynamical stage. You accrete gas. Okay? You accrete matter. And the black hole space-time has, formally, no gas or matter in it. So it can't accrete itself. There's nothing there to accrete. Everything's already accreted down to the center.
And here we have a question.
What is a photon?
Excellent question. A photon's a particle of light. So I spent a lot of time telling you about diffraction and the problems created by the wave nature of light. But of course, quantum mechanics tells us that all these things have wave and particle natures, and a photon's just a one-unit particle of light.
So this is going to sound like kind of a silly question, but you're keep talking about orbit or rotation for a black hole, but it's functionally a featureless system. There's no way you can put a point on the black hole and say, okay, 5 minutes from now that point will be on the other side. There's no actual rotating aspect of it. Is this a side effect of when the black hole collapsed and it was still orbiting something in the first place, or is this a side effect of the actual feature that we just say upspin, downspin, rotating black hole, non-rotating black hole?
So that's an excellent question. What the heck does angular momentum of vacuum space-time mean? So one thing is exactly what you said. You imagine you take a rotating star, and you allow that to collapse into a black hole. That star had angular momentum. And the equations of physics tell us angular momentum is a conserved quantity. It can't just disappear. And so just because it collapsed to a black hole doesn't mean it disappeared. The angular momentum is still there. So one definition of what we mean by black hole spin is exactly that angular momentum. Another way to think of it is the properties of the space-time. Okay, the space-time associated with a spinning black hole is significantly different from the space-time of a black hole that's just sitting there and not rotating. And one of the features of that rotating black hole space-time is this ergo region where it's dragging space with it. So if you imagine trying to sit in your rocket ship and hover fixed relative to the stars far away, you simply couldn't do it. There's no way you could do that even in principle if you got close enough to a rotating black hole. So you can define spin in that way as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Avery Broderick.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's good.